Hi guys, and welcome to episode 2 of the Northern Rugby Podcast. Thanks to everybody who's listened to episode 1 so far. We appreciate all the feedback we've had, so thank you very much for that. Today's episode, we're going to bring you Australian rugby legend Matt Burke, and we're very, very excited to do so. Okay, so Matt was a hero of mine growing up. I absolutely love watching him play, and I'm sure Newcastle Falcons fans have some fond memories of him as well. He was a world champion and a Lions Series winner with Australia, and still holds a number of Australian international records to this day. So we're going to chat with Matt about his accomplishments with Australia, why he left Super Rugby when he did, and how he wound up in the North East with the Newcastle Falcons. So there should be some interesting stories in here. So let's get right to it and see what Matt had to say.
Here we go.
Matt, are you all right, mate?
Darren, I'm well, mate. Yourself?
Yes, very good. Very good. I've got my colleague, Pete Newbiggin, here as well.
Hi, Matt. How are you?
Yeah, good, mate. Sorry, who was that?
Pete.
Hello, Pete. How you doing, buddy? You well?
I'm good, thanks. Good, yeah.
Very good. How's everything going over your neck of the woods with COVID and the rest of it? And I saw footy's back on. I was in rugby's back on.
Yeah, the sport helps. It was a long few months while everything was away. But I think slowly but surely we're getting back to normal. What about you guys?
Yeah, I work at a mob called Network 10. So I'm the sports anchor for Network 10. And fortunately, the rugby league, our chairman or the chairman has been very bullish in getting the games going again. They're biosecurity protocols, like everyone's sort of doing at the moment. So we've been sort of up and at them since about April 28, I think it was. And we all sort of went, no chance. But it came through and it's been going ever since. There's some moderate crowds back allowed at the games now. So, rugby's back on, AFL's back on. So it's, and you're right, it's some semblance of normality where you can watch some sport. Otherwise, it's you're rocking a hard place if there's no sport on.
Yeah, I mean, there's only so much housework and gardening you can do, isn't there?
Mind you, mate, the missus will find more for you. That's okay.
Oh, exactly. Well, Matt, thanks very much for coming on, mate. It's a pleasure to have you here. We just thought we'd talk a little bit about your rugby days, your time with Australia and the Waratahs, and then the move to the Falcons, if that's all right.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. Look forward to it.
So just, mate, take us right back to the start about signing with the Waratahs when rugby went professional and those kind of early days with Australia.
Yeah, it was an interesting time because, I was under the amateur banner for so many years. I came out of school after Australian Schoolboys Tour of the UK, actually. We had a great time. We had 2 months over there touring England, Ireland, Scotland, Wales. I think we went through the Netherlands as well. And then we came back as sort of these young guns to be recruited to the club teams. And recruiting back in those days was basically, let's put on a couple of kegs of beer and see if we can't lure you down to the club that way, where it's obviously completely different nowadays. So I ended up at a place called Eastwood Rugby Club, played my time there for a couple of years, and then slowly worked my way into a representative colour. So you look at, New South Wales under 21s, Australia under 21s, that then progressed to Australian Sevens, to the Wallabies. And you then sort of, you're on the journey then, I suppose you could say. And then in 1996, it all turned professional. You guys were sort of the back end of that 95. We were at the start of that 96 and after the World Cup. And that's when the Waratahs came through. So we were getting paid, good money at the time. And the coaches, they knew that they owned you now because you were professional. And I was only talking to a couple of guys today about, back in the day, and we used to be in the pool. We used to have a pool session at 6 a.m. And if you were late, it was a $50 fine. And then I think it was like 50 bucks every 5 minutes after that or thereabouts. And I vividly remember a guy turning up and it was 5:59 and we were just about to jump in and the skidding of his car as he hit the handbrake. running out and derobing as he dived into the pool to beat the hooter for that 6 o'clock mark. So all of a sudden we're under a new regime, we weren't supposed to drink all that much and skin folds and lifting was all part of it these days. And it went very much out of kilter, as in the balance went too far one way. A couple of years later, it went too far the other way. And then we eventually ended up finding the middle ground. And that's, I suppose, how and why, as an Australian team, we did so well. So we balanced the training and the playing to the socializing and being normal, if you call it that. So
yeah,
but we had a great time doing it. And I mean, I remember driving home from North Sydney Oval, which is just outside of the city here in Sydney, and I used to drive what was called a Mitsubishi Sigma. And for all those listening, look it up. It was a piece of you know what. And I remember thinking to myself, I could buy a Ford Focus now, thinking, how good's this? You know, like life is getting so much better. So, you know, the amateur days left, but we were still under that amateur banner. You know, we still had a really good group of guys that, you know, worked hard and still had the same ethos of the old days.
Yeah. And you mentioned the World Cup. So you were part of the Australian 95 World Cup squad, is that right?
Yeah, I went to 3 World Cups. 95. So on the back of our guys winning in 1991, we went into South Africa as defending champions. We had a bit of a team that was a bit older, a bit lamer, if you call it that. A couple of injuries that were sort of perhaps maybe shouldn't have gone away to that World Cup in that preparation for the World Cup. And then it became those first couple of games, and I got a start in the end against... there was against your boys, against England. I played a couple of games prior to that, but when that quarter final, when Rob Andrew kicks the goal, and you know we're on the plane back to Australia basically, and the irony of it was, you know, as we landed in Perth, which was the stop off over in those days, there we had all our supporters going over expecting us to play in the semi-finals and finals, and that was a big reality check of where we were in world rugby at the time. The other irony of it was, you know, roll on. Or was that 1995? Roll on 10 years later, and Rob Andrews, my coach in Newcastle, and I walk into the office there, and he smiled and he said, "Have you gone over that field goal yet?" And I cheekily said back to him, "Was that yours or Wilco's?" You know, in 2003. So we've been done over twice by your crew, but 95 was something special, an eye opener as to you know how big, how strong, how fast world rugby is. And it's only gotten bigger and bigger and stronger and faster over the time.
Yeah, and I mean, everybody kind of looks back at that World Cup, and the lasting image they have is of the final, and rightly so. But as a kind of young guy coming into your first World Cup, you know, what did you take away from it?
My biggest one was, and it was because it was going to be Australia New Zealand for so many years, was the then emergence of Jonah Lomu. You know, we got on the plane and we were basically sitting next to the Kiwis on the way over to South Africa. And this bloke walked on the plane. I remember sitting next to Josh Cronfield and I went, "Wow, rowers." And he went, "No, mate, that's the winger." And I was like, "What's this?" And then, you know, we know Jonah as just that one named person, you know, and he struck fear in everybody. So, you know, for that, I mean, here was one story to come out. Obviously, you know, Joel Stransky kicking that field goal in the final with the, you know, the jumbo going over Ellis Park beforehand, and Nelson Mandela, you know helicoptering into the box training session, and you know that turned a nation, and that's the bigger picture, I suppose, of that 95 World Cup. And I look back on it and think, you know, were we ever a chance of winning? Probably not really. You know, but we had a great time, and we're over there, and as you do when you tour, but the enormity of what was a World Cup, I don't think hit us in what was a very professional World Cup shown by South Africa. And so it was a massive learning curve, a steep learning curve to then try and better yourself and be the best you can be in that international scene. And yeah, that was my goal for the next, you know, sort of 10 years after that.
Yeah. And you kind of fast forward then 4 years later to 99. What were your kind of thoughts going into that World Cup? Were you guys heavily favoured? Were you feeling any pressure?
I don't think there was any pressure. I think we justified the work that we'd been doing in the previous couple of years in that last Bledisloe in Sydney in the rain. And we ended up winning in Sydney. I think it was 28-7, I think it was. And at that stage there, we knew that, okay, we can beat, you know, New Zealand. Okay, they didn't win the World Cup in 95, but they were the best team in the world. You know, they were ranked one. They won everything. They won Bledisloes and everything else after that, Tri-Nations. But we had a rough time of it.
Yeah.
In 1997, You know, we went over to Argentina and we lost against Argentina in Argentina in what was a turning point for Australian rugby. So the previous coach, Greg Smith, got the flick. A guy called Rod McQueen comes in and he transformed the team. So where we used to stay, and most teams stayed in hotels, and you're living, you know, 2 feet away from a mate for however many weeks, we ended up basing ourselves in far north Queensland and basically living the life and then using that as our base. So that became our home for the next period of time. So we weren't so much on the road, but we were based and then we moved from there. So, you know, for example, when we played down in Carisbrook in Dunedin, we took a flight out of Coffs Harbour by the time we changed our digs to Coffs Harbour. And yeah, that was unprecedented. You know, normally it was, you know, the go to the major cities and take a flight from there. But we were able to convince, I suppose, the rugby union that it was going to be worthwhile to go straight in there rather than that, you know, New Zealand's potentially 2 hours away. It takes you nearly all day to get to New Zealand from Australia.
Yeah.
And it's exhausting. So a few things changed, the mentality changed, and we started winning some games. But, you know, that World Cup, apart from, you know, making it through and slowly climbing out of the pool stages, playing Wales in a quarter final, a South African epic in Twickenham, where there was no try scored. It was probably one of my favourite games ever. You know, went to extra time to that final against France. And, you know, you have your footballing memories, but the memories outside of that was, you know, when we left the hotel at the Cardiff Bay Hotel. I mean, Cardiff's a small city, and every man and his dog basically parked everywhere, and we couldn't get the bus out of the car park at the Cardiff Bay Hotel because everyone basically parked us in. So the bus couldn't make it around the corner. So the blokes in suits, our blokes who weren't playing, got out of the bus and basically bounced a couple of cars and lifted a couple of cars out of the way. I just imagine, you're exactly right. I just imagine the bloke at the end of the night thinking, I'm sure I didn't park here, you know, when he stumbles home after a big night on the juice. So, you know, it was small things that the memories of flying back, you know, having a sing-along on the plane on the way home as we left London, going to the Prime Minister's house, the Lodge, as it's called, and having a night with the Prime Minister and our family was just memories that are priceless. And we did it with a great bunch of guys. And that was probably the great thing about it.
So fast forward a couple of years, you had a Lions tour coming over as well. I mean, what was that like playing in that? Because you pretty much only get one chance at that as a player with every 12 years. What was it like to play in that high pressure environment of the Lions tour?
Do you know, it was interesting because I think it wasn't until after we got beaten in that first game did we realise just how big this thing was. I mean, the Lions for you guys is massive, you know, and I look back on history now and say maybe we didn't give it enough credence in that first game when we walked out in Brisbane. And then subsequently watching the videos of Jono walking into the change room, basically sort of, you know, with a very much exclamation of saying this is a home game with the amount of red shirts that are in the crowd. And, you know, we saw this tour, you know, go through Perth and then go through Brisbane and New South Wales and ACT. And to be honest, I don't think we gave it enough love. You know, we knew of 1989 and Campisi and the throw over the shoulder and Greg Martin, but, you know, it was few and far between for us. And then once we lost that first game and I'll never forget, you know, John Muggleton, our defensive coach, screaming at us at halftime, saying, boys, you've got to do, you know, A, B, and C and you know, stick to the plans. And I remember Daniel Herbert saying, mate, A, B, and C is not working out there. You know, we are in sixes and sevens because of the way that this back line was playing, of Wilkinson, O'Driscoll, and crew running lines that we sort of hadn't seen before. They were playing with width and at pace, and they're playing flat, and we just couldn't stop them.
I just have to ask you one quick question. As an Irishman, what did you make of O'Driscoll's try?
Well, I thought with that Burke heritage, I better let some Irish guys through, didn't I? You know, that was the That was the one. Do you know the interesting part about that is the way I always defended when I was playing at fullback was you rush the bloke, you rush the guy who's coming at you, because what they're trying to do is look for players on the left and on their right. And as they look for their players on the left and their right, they don't see you advancing to them, you know, and you take away their time and space. And Dricko basically looked left and looked right and then went like, you know, bang, step. And I was just caught off. You know, you don't flatten them in a tackle, but you have this ability just to sort of get half a shot. And it did me all ends up, and I fell over in the end. And Dricko then, I think Roffey came and sort of cleaned him up over the try line, but the damage was done. I mean, that was an incredible try. And don't worry, Dricko reminds me of it every time I saw him in the World Cup in Japan.
You got your own back in the second test with the try. So,
well, yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, then we go to Melbourne in this second test, and you know, I've on record saying I was knocked out in that game. I tackled Quinnell into Wood into Johnson, and within about the space of about 3 minutes, and I knocked myself out. You know, I got hit, and I was in gaga land. You know, like I went back out there at halftime, yeah, and Joe scored that try, and I was all over the shop. You know what I mean? So, but we won that game, and we go to Sydney, and you know what an epic match. You know, like, you know, I think the score changed hands, you know, 8 times, and you know there was a crowd of around 90,000 there that day, and they got to watch a serious game of rugby. You know, that was superb, and you know the way it culminated for us, for me kicking a couple of goals, and then Harrison with what was all said during the week with Austin Healey and him stealing the line out and going down to the wire, it was a magic series. And you know, I think those blokes, you know, that was a fair team. You know, when you look at that team, that was a fair team.
Yeah.
And I think they are still a little bit twisted to this day, if you know what I mean. That still grates them to this day. You know, that they think they should have won that tournament, all that series.
Yeah, definitely. I was only 8, and that was one of my first rugby memories, was that series, and just how incredibly high tense the whole thing was. It was incredible to watch this as a young lad. It was brilliant. And then again, you sort of fast forward another 2 years, and you've then got, well, in my opinion, being an Englishman, the best World Cup in history. But I mean, that was incredible as well, having the World Cup in Australia 2 years after.
Fantastic, wasn't it?
So was that sort of a bit of, was there a lot of the English lads in that final wanting a bit of revenge for 2 years earlier?
I think they have spoken about that. Absolutely. Yeah. The disappointment of losing that game was absolutely matter of fact. The irony of it as well, though, you know, the great thing about it, I had a great mate living in London at the time. And so the final was, you know, nighttime. So he stumbles out of a pub, you know, the early morning of this Saturday, and this bloke in a Rolls Royce, He had my 15 jumper on, and a bloke in a Rolls Royce basically tells him to go home back to Australia in no uncertain terms. So it was a win for the ages. But you're right, that 03 World Cup, our guys should have never have made that final. You know, we stole games off New Zealand, certainly in that. In that semi-final, rather. The quarter was against Scotland, if my memory serves me correct. I didn't play those last three games. I was in my suit sitting on the sideline, which was disappointing, but, you know, it was still a thrill to get there, but you lose a bit of that love for it, I suppose you could say. But at the same token, you know, those guys, that game, I mean, Ben Kay should have, you know, put that game beyond doubt when he was basically over the try line. And, you know, but it's, but it's pressure. That's what pressure does to you, you know. And you look at these games, and small things win your games. Yeah. And you know, for us, that kept us in it. You know, Flats kicking those goals was just an incredible moment. I look at you know, the way Wilco held himself and held his nerve on the right foot. And then, you know, again, we're talking about sort of the storyline. you know, a year and a half later, I then go and play with Wilco and up in Newcastle. And my first game was with Newcastle, was against Bath at the Rec there. And he picks up a ball from the halfback 40 metres out and snaps a field goal on his right foot. And I remember running back going, mate, I said, that was special. And then about a minute later, he knocked one on his left foot after sort of doing a pirouette from about 35 out. And I said to him, I said, no wonder we lost the World Cup. And he just started smiling, you know. And I got to know, you know, JW, you know, very well over my time there. And his work ethic was just unbelievable, you know. And so that then, you know, portrayed to the way the young guys trained and played, and guys like Matthew Tate and Jamie Noon and Floody, Jeff Parling, who went on to play for England. So I had a good hand in seeing those guys do their stuff and grow as players. So that was quite an enjoyable feat.
So what actually brought you to Newcastle? What attracted you to Newcastle? Because there would have been, I mean, I guess there would have been a fair few offers around, potentially the likes of France and other sides in England. What was sort of the deciding factor for Newcastle?
Don't say money.
The interesting No. The interesting word was attraction, wasn't it? The attraction to Newcastle. In no uncertain terms, I got told in about the April that in Australia that I was basically too old, too slow. So I had an extension in my contract in their favour, and they basically said, no, we don't want you. So, you know, I'm now 5 months out because most of the contracts are done, you know, over your way and sort of, you know, in the November and December of the previous year. So I then have to find a club, knowing that I can still play. You know, I was still okay, and I thought I was still good enough to play. And so a few clubs came through. There was the Queensland Reds actually threw me a lifeline. I didn't see fit to go to Queensland, having played all my time in New South Wales. There was a couple of second division clubs in France that stuck up their hand. And then the only clubs that were available in the English Premiership were Worcester, who were coming up from relegation to be promoted from second division, and Newcastle because of JW, who was injured from the World Cup. So I basically got a start in Newcastle on the strength of Johnny being injured, but then also Andrew Blades, who was coaching over there and who I played with in the World Cup, basically said, you know, mate, good town, good people, good crew, mid-table team, but you'll have fun when you're over there. And so, you know, and it was not so much it was the pickings of a bad bunch, but then you sort of went, hang on, good blokes, good crew, reasonable team. I reckon I could contribute well to this outfit. And I remember I got asked by one of the journos up there, and I was sitting at the backyard in my place in Sydney, and they said, is it a superannuation package? And I said, look, you know what? One could claim it is because I'm 30 and some. I still think I was 30 and a half at the time. I said, but man, I'm too competitive. You know, I want to play well and prove that I've still got it. And I did, you know, I won the respect of the people up in Newcastle. They are very funny. They used to chant Berkey's a Geordie from the South Stand. And so which means I suppose I ticked the box in proving that I was not just a shot in the arm, that I could actually play and contribute. And, you know, I was able to, you know, captain that team there. And, you know, I as I said before, I think I was able to have a bit of a say in the careers of Tate, Flood, Noon, Parling, and them playing on for England. And you know, hopefully I contributed well. So, you know, I enjoyed my time there. You know, it was 2 years. We ended up being sort of nearly four. And, you know, we had a great time doing it. We had some highlights and some lowlights, but, you know, that's what happens in the game of football.
Yeah, I mean, I've got a couple of memories that stick. I had a season ticket all through those years. So a couple of memories, I mean, getting to the quarterfinal of the Heineken Cup, which is the furthest we've ever got to before. That was incredible, although we got pretty well beaten in Paris.
Yes.
Although
you don't have to remind me of that. I was telling a mate about the other day, but sort of, you know, we're talking about Liverpool and salary caps and that kind of stuff. And I remember the French pack or the starred pack that were out there, and then they took players off and a bloke with 25 caps went off and a bloke with 45 came on. I'm thinking, wow, this is tough, you know. This is, but it was a learning curve, you know. That was, you know, getting through Perpignan at home and you know, making a try-saving tackle was one of my great memories of that 2004-05 season.
Yeah.
You know, and it was great times, great people.
And I mean, a lot of that Falcon side actually went on, either had played international rugby or went on to play. We had a very good young backline, which certainly, having your experience, be interested to speak to them how your experience and expertise helped them a lot. I mean, you had someone like Matt Tate who came through at 15 to help him, and then even the likes of Toby Flood who's still playing now for the Falcons. I'm sure, you know, having someone like yourself in there would have been brilliant. The other memory I have, I think you're the only player I've ever seen that at a 2-on-1 when you're defending, you tackled both players.
I do remember that. Absolutely.
I remember that. I think the whole of Kingston Park's just stood with their mouth wide open thinking, how is that possible that's just happened?
Fantastic. You know, if I can tell you two stories about a story about Floody and Tatey in that 07 World Cup when he was playing for England, he played fullback in that first game against South Africa. I think they got beaten 36-0.
Yeah.
And he rang me on the Friday and I took the phone call and was having a chat to him. And he said, mate, can you give me some tips about fullback? And I went, yeah, absolutely, mate, no worries. You know, like I said, what do you need to know? He goes, well, I'm playing tomorrow against South Africa. And I went, wow, like, you know, talk about being thrown in the deep end. I said, well, first things first, you got to catch the ball on the full. Whenever they kick it to you, don't let the ball bounce, catch it on the full. And he went, yeah, no worries. And I said, then if you catch the ball, you can, you know, you've got options, either running it or kicking it. But, you know, if the option is to kick it, make sure that, you know, you're getting it past the forwards and you find some space. And then I continued to rattle off a few points and that kind of stuff. And I could hear him turning pages in the background. And I said, mate, are you writing notes? And he said, yes. And I went, oh, my goodness, this is going to be a tough day. And it turned out to be a tough day for him. But, you know, he was a genuine speedster and threat. And I loved watching him, you know, apply his trade. Floody, on the other hand, we played a game. And I remember I had a bit of a sore knee and I hadn't been kicking for a while, and Floody was having the kicking duties and he was hitting them incredibly well. And he was, I think the record for the premiership was about 21 from 21. I think it could have been at the time. And he was like 19 from 19. And we went down to Saracens and we're playing there. And we got a penalty at halfway, and being that football pitch, it was a small ground. And I was captain. I said, right, Floody, let's have a shot, mate. Halfway, we're going to have a shot. And he went, I think we should go for touch. I said, no, mate, we're going for goal. We have a shot. And I looked at him, and then it clicked, and I realised that he was 19 for 19. And I went, right. I said, I'm having a shot. And so we turned up, and I've knocked this one from halfway, and it went over. And I looked at him and said, don't ever question me again, if you know what I mean? Like doing that senior statesman. And he went, yeah. And he ended up, I think, hit 23 from 23 or something. But, you know, funny, the agendas flying around left, right and centre for the young boys. But it was it was good times, you know, up in Newcastle. Yeah,
so what was the highlight from Newcastle? If you've got one outstanding memory, it might be of the city, it might be of playing rugby, it might be a certain game that sticks in your memory. What was your ultimate highlight of Newcastle?
Well, I studied a Bachelor of what was called Human Movement. So in the sort of, I suppose, sporting field, exercise physiology. So it doesn't allow me to be a doctor, but I reckon I was self-diagnosed hypothermia one game after playing in Newcastle.
I bet it was probably May or something, yeah.
It was middle of Six Nations, so it was about March, I think it was. Like, and we played Wasps at home, and there was so much water on the pitch that they're going to call the game off. But Wasps had lost half of their pack, and we were a chance of winning, and we ended up winning the game. But it was basically came down to kicking a goal to win the match. And previous to that, I'd fallen into a puddle, and I was literally soaked from head to heel, and it was so cold, and the wind coming through, and Davey Walder, basically stood up and kicked the goal. And they threw me the ball, and I was so cold. I sort of dribbled the ball over, and I said to Davey, I said, "Man, I've got," I've got nothing. But I was blue. I was my cheeks, my legs, my arms. And he said, "Are you sure?" And Delalio gave away a penalty, and then back chatted. So it went from 43 meters to 33 meters, and I walked straight off, straight into the shower, fully dressed, and turned the shower on. And I heard the roar of the crowd, meaning, you know, Walders kicked the goal. And in the euphoria of walking off, the boys came in this change room and absolutely sprayed me for being a soft Aussie, you know, what. So that was my memory. And that was the competitive advantage, though, of playing in Newcastle, was the cold. So, you know, these boys were tough buggers, you know. They rugged up. That day I had on, I think, like a tight vest, tight short sleeve, tight long sleeve, then a jersey. And it didn't do diddly, if you know what I mean. So, but great times in Newcastle, you know. And it was sad to go in the end through injury, but you know, we still got great mates up there whom we talk to all the time.
And Matt, there was a few reports while you were in Newcastle of Australia sending out an SOS. Was there ever any temptation to go back?
Well, there was a truth in that. The Aussie coach at the time, who was a guy called John Connolly, rang me up and said, and I got the voicemail, and he said, we want you back because, you know, 07 World Cup coming up. And I quizzed him and I said, do you mean you want me back as in like a mentoring type role or a water boy type role? And he said, no, there's a spate of injuries and we want you to come back and play. So I spoke to my manager at the time, and then, you know, I sat down with my wife, Kate, and we had holidays booked in the south of France, and that would have meant, you know, sort of foregoing that and then going back to Australia and flying back, accommodation, you know, a fee to play, bonuses. So it was going to be an expensive proposition. And I sat down with my manager on the phone. I said, yeah, this is what we need to go back. And in his meeting with the Australian rugby representative, you know, he's opened up the folder and he said, well, you know, Matthew and his family would have business class flights back for he and his wife and his two kids. And the guy at the other side went, well, that could be expensive. That could be about $30,000 worth. That could be a deal breaker. And my manager basically, you know, snapped his folder shut and said, if that's all you're worried about, you know, we've got some things to talk through. So in the end, I thought it wasn't appropriate to go back, you know, and where I was at Newcastle, I was enjoying my time. And the great part about Newcastle was that I never had to play for a higher representative jersey, if you know what I mean. So there wasn't the pressure on me to play for another jersey like the England boys had to play for. And to the point where, you know, if I played poorly, which fortunately I didn't do too much of, you know, if I did, I could call the coach and say, who was Rob, and say, look, mate, that won't happen again. And I did it on one occasion. We played Gloucester in Newcastle in a wet, you know, windy day. And, you know, I think the score was 8-7, and it was just a nothing game. And I had about three shots at goal at the end there from about halfway into the wind, and they fell short. And, you know, it was just a nothing game. And I got home, and my wife was sort of, you know, saying, you know, you normally don't mope around after a loss. And I said, it was just, this one grated me, you know, and I said, like, I just want to say sorry to Rob, you know, like, as in that won't happen again. And she said, call him. And I went, yeah, righto. So I called him, and we had a chat for about 10 minutes. And then the text message went out from Rob, meet at the club at 8 o'clock tomorrow. And it snowed overnight. And I thought, oh no, what's this? You know, it's going to be a hard session. And he basically stood us out in the cold in a couple of inches worth of snow. And he basically laid down the law to us. And then he finished off by saying, and you know what? Only one bloke had the sort of, what would you call, the kahunas to call me. And I went, oh, Rob, no, don't throw me under the bus, please. And he goes, the only bloke was Berkey. And I remember, you know, 20 sets of eyes just sort of burnt a hole through me. It was like, you know, like, take one for the team, boys. Well done. So, yeah, that was the relationship one I had with Rob as well. Like, I was – it wasn't so much a player. It was more of a player, coach, mentor, sort of helper outer with the other players. So, you know, it worked well from the time when I was over there.
Good man. Matt, what we typically finish up with is an ultimate 15. So we like to get the best players that you've ever played with throughout your career. So it could be the Waratahs, the Aussies, or Newcastle. And the only rule is you have to be in the team yourself. So we're going to go ahead and put you in a fullback, if that's all right.
I'll take that. Absolutely, I'll take that.
So start with whatever position you like. But who's the best you've ever played with?
I think if I go over a 1, 2, and 3, you know, the guys I played with around Australia time, Harry, Kearns, and Blades were pretty special. You know, they formed a really formidable group. They were the Waratahs front row. They became the Australian front row. And you know, you look at you know, someone like Andrew Blades, and you know, he was just a technician. You know, just didn't move at tight head there. Kearnsy was just. Yeah, Kearnsy was a great player, great mate, and a great tourist. So that's probably why he makes the team as well. And a lot of respect for Richard Harry, who was a flanker and then made the transition to Loosehead. So yeah, for doing that was quite special. When you look at that second row, you know, I played with a guy like Justin Harrison, who was fantastically technical in the lineout. You know, I mean, you can't go past a guy called John Eales, I suppose, who had that athletic ability. We did have the nickname of the anvil for Eelsy. They reckon he was just like a dead weight to try and get up in the lineout. But he comes along there for his, you know, athletic ability around the park. Back row, Willie Ofahengawe was someone who was just quite incredible. He was, you know, an explosive power machine when you played, a great player. Todai Kefu in the back row was pretty special. And I played with a guy called David Wilson as well, who was a great thief in the night, you know, when they got around that number 7 role as well. George Smith was pretty special. You know, he played a number of years and he had a great skill set. Yeah. So, you know, hard to differentiate from those guys there. They both had their, you know, strengths and weaknesses. You know, then I played with, you know, guys in the UK who were pretty special as well. You know, Woodsy was pretty good as well when you get around the park there. And, you know, each bring a different trait to their game. And number 9, you're probably thinking George Gregan, and you wouldn't go past him. He played 141 games, 139 games, I think it was, for Australia, who was quite special. But I did have a real affiliation with one of my Waratahs teammates, a guy called Chris Whittaker, who had just an incredible pass on him and sat behind Greggs for so long in that role. So on this occasion, I'm going to give Witz a run over Greggs because he never got too much of a role while George was there. So, you know, I'd probably say Witz on that behalf. And this is where it starts to get difficult now, doesn't it? I played with Wilkinson for a couple of seasons in Newcastle, who was, you know, just a master of the game. And when it came to, you know, working your way around the park, I learned so much from him, from his tactical point of view, from his kicking point of view, from his, you know, just converting points or territory into points with field goals and goals. And, you know, as a goal kicker, you know, when you knock one over, you sometimes sort of lean, don't you? Like, you know, it's like a golfer. So if you bring it back on the fairway, you never lent with Wilco. It was black dot the whole time. Yeah. And that was just purely because of the amount of repetition he did. You know, it was great. Then you go someone like, you know, play with Michael Liner, you know, who was a tradesman in his craft. To then go with Stephen Larkham, who was, you know, one of the great ball running number 10, could not kick for shit, but just run the ball was perfect. You know, so yeah, that's the hard part. What do you go for there? So for an international flavour, I'll chuck in Wilco with Larkham off the bench. You know what I mean? So yeah, so difficult to split. My 12 has to be Johnny. You know, quite part of me, but my 12 has to be Timmy Horan, who was just probably the best player I played with, and apart from that, had skill and pace, but then had this fun element on the park that he could just sledge people and talk to people on the opposition and have fun while you're playing the game. And that's why you play the game. You play the game for that test of skill. And when you test your skill, you have fun while you're doing your trade. And Tim was that. He, you know, that 99 semi-final against South Africa. You know, he was as crook as Rookwood. He was on a deathbed thereabouts and played the game of his life. So that was quite special. When you look at outside centre, I think you have to go with Jason Little. The combination of those guys. You know, I could throw in a Matthew Tate there, who was just electric in his time. But Jace had probably a bit more size on him. Jace was about 6'1 and 100 kilos.
Yeah.
And was effortless in the way he ran. And this is where it becomes difficult again when I'm talking about a couple of wingers. And I look at Waratahs and whom I play with there and who I play with up in Newcastle and Michael Stevenson, where I played with up there, who had just jet shoes.
Yeah, he was just raw pace, wasn't he?
Wasn't he? What? And when you're playing 15 and you shift it to those blokes and then they gas it and you just go, yep, that's why you play on the width there.
He didn't get enough national recognition though, did he? I mean,
that's so true.
England dozens of times, but
that's exactly right. Steve-O was electric, absolutely. So he gets an honourable mention. Then I look at someone like Tommy May, who was on the other side, who was just built like a brick. Sort of our house, if you know what I mean, saying it politely, you know, and just was so energetic, you know, and it was great to get a different sense of enthusiasm when I went to Newcastle. Then you look at the guys I play with in Australia, Ben Tune, you know, just a wrecking ball, just pure speed. Sadly, injuries took their toll at the end there. Joe Roth, an incredible player. So I think I probably have Roffey on one wing. He was sublime. He was just, you know, he was 6'2", 6'3". And just could motor, looked like he wasn't moving. And I suppose, and because I played with in a Jonah comeback game, Jono retirement game, I'd have to say Jonah Lomu. You know, having played with him, and the special part about him was, you know, we sat down at a dinner one night and he was asked the question, you know, were you ever fully fit? You know, and that was the whole thing. And he sat there and he's, black tie, 500 pound a head dinner. And he said, I was only 75% fit. And the whole place just went silent. And I remember going, wow, like that's just quite incredible. For someone who was so devastating and was never fully fit and sadly passed for 5 years, you know, he'll be forever remembered as that guy. And the great part about it was, and I'll never forget, we played and Tatey was the opposition fullback. And I was running through. I got this ball. It was about 20 yards out. And I could have scored. And I went, no, I'll give it to Jonah. And I threw it to Jonah. And just to see him run, but more so to see what I look like when I was trying to tackle him in Tatey's eyes, with the eyes thinking, how am I going to stop this bloke? And it was just brilliant to watch. So probably Jonah. I mean, I could throw in a whole heap of other names there, like Dan Carter and sort of, you know, other blokes on the way through. I played with Lawrence Delalio in a Barbarians year, Augustine Pichot at nine, Carlos Spencer in a Barbars, Brian O'Driscoll. I'll take Brian O'Driscoll purely from the social side. I mean, I've had the beauty of playing with some incredible players. Obviously, there's an Australian bias there, but you know, when you look around of who's dominated Australian and international headlines, there's been some incredible players, and to have been a part of that and to be in the mix in someone else's team, you know, I was very grateful, or eternally grateful, if that's the word.
So I've got a question that I heard a South African World Cup winner and Lions Tour winner say it.
Yep.
Probably go back a few months. I can't remember who it was. Someone like Brian Habana had said, winning a Lions Tour was more of an achievement than winning a World Cup. Now, out of the two, you know, which for you, because you're a World Cup winner and a Lions winner, what was more special for you?
Well, you can the way you, I think the way you, I could equate that is that, you know, you look at what our run was. We went Romania, America, Ireland in our pool matches, into Wales, into South Africa, into France. So we never played New Zealand, you know, who were the, you know, no doubt the best team in the world. And so, yeah, is there an asterisk beside that? You could say yes, but we beat New Zealand in the Bledisloe Cup a couple of months earlier. So I'd now erase that asterisk. When you look at the Lions series and back to back to back, that was quite special, you know, when, and coming from 1-0 down to win 2-1, you know, I would probably say, yeah, absolutely. That series was quite incredible. When as history goes past, you probably realize more of what you're able to achieve in that Lions series, especially then going over and playing in the UK and seeing what it meant to people in England, Ireland, Scotland, and Wales, if you know what I mean. You know, to represent your country at a World Cup, yeah, that's special. And there's not many people who can say they're World Cup champions. And I always take the mickey out of people and saying, who was that bloke that kicked 25 points in the final in 99? Oh, sorry, that was me, you know, like, and taking the mickey out of it that way. But, yeah, so that's something you can never take away. But in terms of a series, winning 1998 Bledisloe 3-0, that was special. And winning the Lions, I think that's on par. So can I separate them? You know, in a roundabout way, boys, I don't think I can. I don't think I can. You know, each to their own. In you know, climbing, you know, we use the mantra of climbing Everest for that World Cup, you know, and a lot of people get not far from the point of Everest, from the top of Everest, and they fall apart. And for ours was, you know, we've got to reach the summit. You know, we've got to make sure we go the whole way. But that's that Lions series, yeah, that was special. And coming from 1-0 down to win 2-1, absolutely.
Well, thanks for the insight, Matt. It's been fantastic to talk to you.
Yeah, thank you very much, Matt. It's been a pleasure.
Oh, thanks, boys. Now I've indulged in memories of what I did for fun, if you know what I mean. I mean, I got paid for playing a hobby. As I try and explain it to some people sometimes. So I'm now in a real job now. So so doing what I did was absolutely fantastic. And look, thanks for giving me the opportunity to share these memories. And hopefully it evokes a lot of memories for a lot of people, you know, who are listening in.
Certainly from my perspective, having a season ticket for those few years that you were in Newcastle, it was just, you know, some of the best rugby that that you could watch, and it was just a privilege at times. So thank you very much for reminding me of those brilliant years.
No, good. The only sad thing about that time at Newcastle is one, I finished on an injury, which was disappointing. Yeah. But two, not playing probably enough rugby with Johnny, if that's the word, because he was away and he was a bit crook. But I tell you what, I don't miss those cold nights up in the Toon. I live about 100 yards from the beach, so I think I'll take that over the Toon every day of the week.
It's absolutely peeing it down here at the minute, Matt. So you're not missing
them. Fantastic. Good stuff, boys. Thanks for your time, and I look forward to having a chat down the track if you ever want to.
Brilliant. Thank you very much, Matt. Really enjoyed that.
Look after yourself, big man.
Good on you, Dan. Good on you, Pete. Take care, boys. Take care.
Mate, Matt Burke. What a player. What a lad.
Incredible. I mean, he was certainly my rugby hero growing up. That first memory, I mean, one of my first rugby memories was that 2001 Lions tour, and just seeing how good he was then. And then for him to come to Newcastle was brilliant. And a brilliant lad as well. Brilliant to speak to.
Yeah. I remember obviously being Irish, we don't like the English that much. and in the build-up to that 2003 World Cup, everybody had the Matt Burke shirts. He was a bit of a folk hero. We thought they were the only team that could stop England. Sadly, it didn't happen, but there you go. But no, hell of a man, hell of a player. Hell of a career. He talked there about the 25 points in the World Cup final, a record that probably will never be beaten.
No, I mean, just some of his achievements that the more you dig into it, the more you see. I mean, he scored in that second Lions test, that 3-0 Bledisloe Cup against New Zealand, and just been the most solid fullback that probably the Southern Hemisphere has ever had.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people, if you're asking for a best ever 15, is Matt Burke 15?
He would be my 15, yeah. 10, 13. I mean,
I think that's fair.
He was just all around. He had everything. I mean, he certainly wasn't the prettiest player. He wasn't going to, you know, score 4 or 5 tries a game and run around defenders, but you know that the basics were done just absolutely solidly.
Well, guys, that's it for episode 2. We're going to wrap it up, but hopefully you've enjoyed us in the mat as much as we did. Hopefully we didn't sound like two little fanboys. but it was great to speak to him and hear some of those memories from his perspective. So we're going to wrap up today. If you liked the episode, please do subscribe. You know where to find us. You can find us on the Anchor Podcast app, the Anchor Podcast website, or you can subscribe to the channel on YouTube. Please do follow us on Twitter as well to keep up with all the latest episodes. We're hopefully going to get a few more out in the weeks and months to come. So we'll see you guys next time.